information that relates to the weapon. That's what the courts have required, and it's so hard to prove. Whereas if you have the standard impaired, when the officer approaches the person who is intoxicated with the weapon, they talk to each other, and what the person who's drunk says indicates their level of sobriety or lack thereof most of the time. They slur their speech, they say irrational things, they create a record of their impairment that lets any objective person, the juror, know that they were intoxicated, but it did not relate to the gun. It was...
Isn't this somewhat similar problem proof that you have when you have an operating motor vehicle while intoxicated, and you have a person who's operating it by turning on the radio, and they're sitting behind it, and there's no showing that this person has even driven the car, but they're sitting operating the motor vehicle by having the ignition on or having the key in operating the radio, and there you don't have to show it's a similarly drafted statute, as I recall. It does tie it to the ability to operate the car, but it's done by some kind of a presumption through a certain blood level alcohol, and maybe the answer is to have some kind of a blood level alcohol here or something that you would have the same thing as you have with an envoy. But if you have quote impaired, I think you're going to be buying yourself a lawsuit up at least to the Court of Appeals, because who's going to know what impaired is? And if they say anything, they're going to say exactly the same as they're going to read it the same way as they'd read an envoy statute anyway. So you might as well say it in the statute. The word impaired without more, I think, is going to just be very vague.
May I respond, Mr. Chairman? Mm-hmm. For the reasons Ms. Otto expressed, I don't think we could use the blood alcohol level, per se.
But why not?
Because you need to be able to test the person's blood alcohol level, and to do that you need a breath sample or a blood sample, mm-hmm. and there isn't any hammer to make them give you that sample. The state does not have the authority to take breath or blood samples involuntarily. All we can do is make sure you're not going to drive for a substantial period of time or put you in jail for having accepted a driver's license and now reneging on your promise to provide the blood sample in a DWI case. It all gets tied to the privilege to drive, and we don't have a privilege to possess weapons. It's, I believe, a constitutional right in this state, and so we don't have...
I don't think there's a constitutional right to possess them if you intend to possess them when you're impaired.
I would agree that we have the ability to regulate that, and that's what we're trying to do, is to regulate it effectively. So to have impaired, I think, would improve our ability to keep guns out of the hands of drunks.
Well, the hammer you have with Mr. Chairman, the hammer you have with the car is you take away the privilege to drive, and that's the implied consent. And that's a practical problem of how do you get them to agree to give you the blood sample or the breath test. But here you have a different kind of a hammer, I think, because you already have them violating the law by definition the way this statute is drafted. The way it is you're already violating the trespass law. And that trespass law is a Class A misdemeanor. And so in other words, you do have a definite hammer because you're already going to be able to prosecute them for one crime anyway.
So I don't understand what you're getting at.
Well, what I'm
you're saying you should threaten them with the prosecution to
sure.
get a blood sample from them?
Sure.
Then it would be suppressed for that reason.
That's a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights.
You cannot force somebody to give a breath sample. If you put a .10 standard in, if you thought somebody was intoxicated, what the police would have to do is get a search warrant and get their blood drawn, and it basically is an impossibility.
Doesn't Schmerber say that you don't need a search warrant?
Because there's implied consent, because driving is a privilege. And one of the things that you agree to when you get the privilege to drive is to give breath sample. That's what implied consent means. By getting a driver's license, you're impliedly...
You can't go to someone's house and say, we're going to charge you with this robbery if you don't let us come in and search. That's exactly what you're advocating here, and that's, you can't do that.
No, but what I am saying, and I don't know, obviously, I haven't done any research on this, but here you have a situation where somebody is already violating a statute, and as a practical matter, the police who are already on the premises, assuming, presumably, at the request of the homeowner. They're already there to arrest the person for the trespass. And they see that the person has a gun and it appears to be intoxicated. Therefore, there's no need for a search warrant to be on the premises because they're there at the invitation of the owner, first of all.
Yeah, but...
How are you going to get their blood sample?
That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in the blood sample.
I understand that. And my question is... whether there have been any statutes or any cases considering, under those circumstances, whether with a statute like this there would be a right to draw blood, or whether that would constitute an unreasonable search.
Absolutely, it would constitute an unreasonable search. You have to have a search warrant for it. There is one exception that we make in the law that I'm aware of, and that is for breath samples for somebody who is driving a motor vehicle, and the courts go through all kinds of convoluted reasonings for how there's implied consent that's based on getting a privilege to drive. It's the only exception that I'm aware of, and maybe, and I see both Ms. Horetsky and I assume Ms. Knuth. Do you know of any other exceptions?
Well, it's narrower than that. If to involuntarily take a sample, the person has to have been in an accident causing harm to another person or damage to a vehicle, right, and be unconscious.
Right. If somebody refuses, yeah, the only, yeah, alternative is to charge them with refusal. If somebody refuses to give a blood, to give a breath sample, and you arrest them for DWI, you cannot take them down in front of a magistrate, get a search warrant, and have their blood drawn. Because the legislature's provided one way of getting it, and that's a breath sample. You can charge them with refusal to take a breath test, and that's the whole reason that the legislature created that crime, is to make it so people don't have an incentive to not take a breath test. But you can't seize anything from somebody without a warrant, except for the exceptions that have been provided.
I'm still somewhat uncomfortable, and I think that you're not getting where you want to go by simply leaving it undefined as quote impaired. That has been my concern. The term impaired is vague. I just don't know how you do it.
Okay. Well, I think we Rube Andrews, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a chance to look at the committee substitute, the proposed committee substitute?
Yes, I had a chance this afternoon to look it over. For the record, my name is Rube Andrews. I represent the National Rifle Association in Alaska. In looking over the committee substitute this afternoon, I see where it's a bill that is trying to approach and solve a lot of problems, and I think it creates some problems in doing that. And I'll try to point out what I think are some constructive amendments and changes that we would perhaps like to see, starting on page 2. I'll try not to go over some of the comments that have been made previously. Looking at section 4, going down to lines 13 and 14, we would feel more comfortable if you just omitted the language after knowingly possesses a firearm, omit from there on after semi-automatic firearm, and it would read, knowingly possesses a firearm after having been convicted of a felony by a court of this state. I can't see any reason why you would want to be able to rearm a convicted felon with a long gun. And we have a lot of problems in why you're picking on semi-automatic actions, because they're not inherently evil because it's a semi-automatic action. Why don't we just disarm them? You know, they're convicted felons. Line 16, section 2. Again, we would say knowingly sells or transfers a firearm, then omit from that point on to line 17, omit capable of being concealed on one's person or a semi-automatic firearm, and it would read, knowingly sells or transfers a firearm to a person who has been convicted of a felony by a court, etc. To us, that makes a lot more sense. Maybe there's some reason that I'm not aware of why you would want to allow convicted felons to have long guns or non-concealable guns or guns that are not semi-automatic in their action. But I'm not, somehow that's escaping
me. A lot of people with felonies in the bush, you know, survive off the land. They shoot ducks, geese, hunt.
What you're proposing in here is to change that period of time from 5 years to 10 years when they can possess and use a firearm. Am I correct?
No. The only thing they're prohibited from having now is concealable firearms.
What I'm saying is
and
they should not have any firearms.
And we're just saying in addition, yeah, I know that's what you're saying, but there's a lot of reasons why you don't want to do that with people who are subsistence hunters and fishermen.
It is for a period of 10 years raising it from 5.
Right.
You're correct on
that. But yeah. You do that thing, and then in addition to concealable weapons, semi-autos. And I understand your point about semi-automatic.
If you know something about the bush, if that's your rationale about subsistence hunting, the semi-automatic firearm is a very, very popular firearm. And the Mini 14, I'll just pick on one brand right off the bat. The River Mini 14 is one that's...
I don't think there's any question it's a popular firearm. The question is whether it's necessary to hunt. I don't think it's necessary. And what we want to do is provide these people with the minimum necessary to subsist.
Right? This also applies to people in urban areas, too.
Right.
Going on to page 3, Mr. Chairman.
It only applies to felons.
That's right. But... You're going to arm them with long guns, let's say pumps and bolt actions or lever actions, and anyone who knows anything about firearms, you can be awfully, awfully fast and effective with any one of these.
Sure.
Yeah, may. Page 3. Again, looking down at line 8, section 10, we would like to see on line 9 the following words omitted from this, or a semi-automatic firearm. And it would read, concealed on one's person or prohibited weapon in the dwelling if the person has been convicted of a felony by this court and so forth. Again, for the same reason I just mentioned, is that if we're looking at Bush, Alaska, firearm for subsistence, there's no way they can live in a residence without a semi-automatic action in Bush, Alaska, as far as I'm concerned. I see nothing but semi-automatic actions out there. There's a lot of bolt action too and lever action, but there's an awful lot of semi-automatic actions. You're picking on an action, on a mechanical action.
That's really what this is coming down to, right? You just don't want anything in the statutes that mention semi-automatics.
That's correct.
That's
Mr.
really
True.
What you're getting at.
That's correct.
It doesn't have anything to do with the rationality of what we're getting at here, just as you're opposed that it's the first encroachment on a particular class of weapon, is I think what you're getting at.
It's an encroachment on a particular action
right.
That's been around over 100 years.
Right.
And I don't think that there's any justification. If you're going to let them have arms anyway, which is your intent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess if... I don't have any questions for you.
I just understand you're saying that it's inclusive in the wording that you're proposing, or like if in that last one you cited there it says prohibited weapon, semi-automatic would be a prohibited weapon under your understanding.
An automatic?
Maybe a semi-automatic.
Yeah.
Would be a prohibited weapon.
Right. The list of prohibited weapons is very clear.
Well, it wouldn't be a prohibited weapon unless you were a felon.
That's correct.
There's some prohibited weapons that are prohibited for everybody, and there's others that are just if you had a recent felony.
That's right.
Or crime class.
But it would be inclusive for that for a convicted felon.
Right.
Or a previously convicted
felon. Right. If somebody was convicted of a felony, it would be included as prohibited, yeah.
So I would...
If I understand you right, that would be part of... He's just saying, say it without saying, that's what it sounds like.
Well, I think, yeah. I've got a question for you, though, on a related subject. There was earlier testimony about providing legalizing switchblades and gravity knives. Do you think we could address those concerns with some sort of licensing procedure for those classes of weapons? Let's say that we adopted that somebody, if they wanted to, if you really want to keep these weapons out of the hands of kids or people who are going to abuse them, but you still want to give collectors an option to have these type of things, why not just let anybody who wants one pay a $50 license fee and for a collector's licensing fee and then be able to have a set of brass knuckles or a switchblade knife or whatever, and they just register them and say, these are the ones I've got, and send it in with your $50, and you can have your collection, because I don't imagine anybody who's going to misuse those things is going to go through that trouble to do that, right? But only somebody who you know, wants to spend $50, you know, to get a license to collect them. Is that something that the NRA would be interested in as an option?
Sure. Well, frankly, our business isn't knives. We're firearms, but I really appreciated the testimony of that witness. It was some of the most logical and comprehensive testimony I've heard in a long time. I did miss something in his testimony, though. What was his definition of butterfly knife? I wasn't quite sure I heard that correctly or heard it at all.
It's a knife that you can open like this.
Well, let me show you. This is not only a knife, Bill. There's tens of thousands of these things or hundreds of thousands of these things around. It's a sportsman tool, and when I open it up, you can see that it's mostly tools. But here's a blade, too. And if your definition is that the handles fold around the blade, what are we going to do with this kind of a tool? It's got screwdrivers, files, you know, pliers.
I got one at home.
You know, what I'm saying is give us a break. we can't solve all the problems there, I guess. I'm going to pass that around if you haven't seen one.
Yeah, somehow I really
that's
doubt
hand in a pocket
would
shirt.
Bother anybody.
Yeah. Anyway, and also on page 4, I'd like to bring up another point, too. You've added under lines 26, 27, you're adding new language, subsections 4 and 5. We have problems with this and just wonder about it. And for example, probably you're all familiar with the personal protection vest that a lot of policemen in our troops wear. They're made of Kevlar. Kevlar is a synthetic material that it's layered in this vest, and it will stop a lot of different calibers of bullets. But it won't stop an ice pick. Guaranteed not to. Thank you. And I see that you're concerned about switchblades, gravity knives, and butterfly knives. Here's really a dangerous weapon to anyone that's wearing a Kevlar protection vest. So again, I'm just pointing out that you can't solve all these problems in one single legislation, I guess.
I don't understand your point, Rupert. This is where we reduce the penalties for these things.
I don't understand
what your point is.
Right, but the thing is, you're listing them there.
Yeah, well, they're in the statute now. We're reducing the penalties there for them.
It starts up above it. A person commits a crime of misconduct.
Right. It used
in
to
the
be
second
a,
degree.
It used to be a prohibited weapon altogether. Just so we're dropping it from being a felony, having possession, to here where only if you manufacture, sell, or transfer them.
So it's only.
I mean, the only difference here is we're reducing the penalty for mere possession, and we're adding the sale of butterfly knives as being a prohibited activity. That's the only change that's taking place there.
Well, like I say, knives are not our expertise or mine either, but whatever you decide. I'll go on to page 5, though, where I think there is a problem I'd like to point out. And we're looking at lines 8 through 13. Frankly, I look at this as a real section to prohibit the use of any firearms on school property. If you look at it in this direction, when you look at line 10, without the permission of the chief administrative officer, he's going to come under liability if he gives permission and then there's negligent use of a firearm on school property. How many chief administrative officers are going to assume that liability?
Well, they all do it in Anchorage now.
They're going to take the easy way out and say,
everybody has a rifle team in Anchorage does this now.
They do it now?
Well,
chief,
yeah.
Chief administrative officers?
Well, if they're not authorized by the school district.
But here, as I understand it,
municipal ordinance against it.
It changes it to a specific situation where he must give permission, is the way I understand it. If not, I'll stand corrected.
Well, the CS
no.
doesn't do that. It says without the permission.
No. It gives the discretion. Intends clearly not to require it.
The Anchorage ordinance reads, you can't have it at all unless they have express authorization of the Anchorage School District Superintendent or his designee, or in the case of a private or religious school, express authorization of the chief administrative officer of that school. That's what the law in Anchorage is.
We've
got lots of rifle teams in Anchorage.
We got lots of them in Anchorage. We have them in Tok. We have them in Fairbanks.
It's not a problem.
We have them here. You know, we shoot on
so
a school.
So this hasn't
property.
Caused any problem with those rifle teams in Anchorage?
But that's a local ordinance, right?
Right.
And we're talking about state statute here.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not mean that much, but I'd like to point out that when you start laying liability on bureaucrats, they're going to get awfully, awfully defensive and take the safe way out and say, no, I prohibit this.
I bet people would probably get rid of them then.
I love democracy, yeah.
Right.
That concludes any comments that I have on the committee substitute, Mr. Chairman.
Remember?
Yeah, I made quite a thing one of our last hearings about another aspect of a section that you dealt with on page 3, lines 8 through 11. And the problems in the bush, and you, I think, have maybe more experience with this than I. I know there are some villages in the bush where a large number of the people have been convicted of felonies for various times, where there's alcohol problems and stuff. And they're extended families, and they live together in the same residence in many cases. And I'm concerned about a person who may have a number of years ago been convicted of a felony, maybe an older person who had hell-raising time in his youth or something like this, and happened to live in a dwelling, and somebody else happens to have a pistol there, for example. That prohibited weapons doesn't give me a lot of problem, because the list of prohibited weapons in Section 6, I mean, who's going to have a rocket in their house, or a hand grenade, or something like that? That doesn't mean, those are clearly but particularly a handgun. Is it in fact the case that a lot of people in the bush do in their house somewhere, some person would have a handgun?
Mr. Chairman, I think the short answer to that is yes, and Ms. Arnold, the counsel for the committee here, has lived in Bethel a long, long time. She can answer with much more expertise than I can on that. But I can tell you, every study the University of Alaska has made in Bush, Alaska, the number of personally owned firearms in each dwelling is astronomical. I mean, compared to other areas, the average is 21 in one study that I showed. And small caliber, flat shooting, high capacity type guns are what they really like the Mini 14 I picked on that one. There's a lot of AK 16s out there too, as a matter of fact. But there's a lot of handguns too.
That's one thing that does bother me about this.
Any other questions for the witness? Thanks. Okay. We got a couple of choices with this. I myself am pretty satisfied with the way it is now. I feel real comfortable with the way it is now, as a matter of fact. I'll leave it up to the committee. I guess the choices are if the committee doesn't feel that way, then we could put it into a subcommittee and study it some more. If there's any specific proposals to change in the CS, entertain those too. I haven't gone around to talk to you as individuals about it, so I don't know what I have. How are you feeling about it? There's some part of it?
I'm just thinking that the indication of a semi-automatic firearm could well come under the list of definitions for prohibited weapons.
You don't want to put them under prohibited weapons because then you couldn't have ordinary people on them.
Well, in some other fashion that would accommodate that, then, Mr. Chairman. I haven't had time to look at that too, but I understand what Mr. Andrews is alluding to. And somehow you can accommodate that need without having it all over the face of the document, it seems to me. And there'd be some point of reference for it.
I don't, you know, I think Mr. Andrews would still be real concerned about it because he'd be doing the same thing, just a different use. You know, you'd just be making it more difficult for the public to find out what it is. And I think the concern here is just a philosophical concern that there should be no distinction made against different types of mechanisms or actions. I think the NRA has the same position on fully automatics. That their position is they shouldn't be prohibited either. So,
if you were to take, as he says, knowingly possesses a firearm after having been convicted of a felony, how does that differ with the language that you've already done? You're saying that a semi-automatic doesn't meet the criteria for a firearm?
Mm-hmm. Could you restate your question?
As he says here, he says if you put in knowingly possesses a firearm and you drop down to after having been convicted of a felony,
mm-hmm.
So you eliminate concealed. See, he's eliminating concealed.
Although, Mr. Chairman, what he was going to do is prohibit felons from having any type of firearm at all. Right now, I believe only concealable weapons are prohibited from felons within this time frame that they're
allowed. 5-year time.
So his amendment, I think, would have prohibited all weapons, and the reasoning was that some people need to hunt, so they need a rifle or a shotgun, probably not a semi-automatic shotgun, but under this. So I think the policy call is do we want to include, and I guess the concern of the NRA, and I have somewhat of the same concern, is that by doing this, even though it's just for felons, and I don't particularly have a problem for that, you're also making a statement or a policy call that semi-automatic weapons are more dangerous than non-semi-automatic weapons. So you've made that first statement because you're willing to put it in here for felons, so that the natural progression is possibly that if it is more dangerous, does it rise to the point of becoming too dangerous for the general public as well.
Yeah.
So it's not so much whether it shows up right here. I agree that whether it shows up here or we can put them all in one section, I don't think that's the concern. The concern is whether this shows up at all.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I would violently, I would fight to the bitter end here if we were trying to prohibit semi-autos from the public, from people who didn't have felony convictions. I'd go down in flames on that one before I'd let that go through me. But
he's talking about,
but when we're talking about convicted felons,
that's right.
I think from the fact is I own some semi-autos, and the reason I own them is because there's more firepower there than a regular rifle. You can clip fed. You can just, there's a lot more, defensive ability there. And they're a more effective weapon, or else military wouldn't have gone away from bolt action rifles in favor of semi-automatics. It's just a fact. Yeah, that's right. Well, how does the committee feel? Do you want this to go into subcommittee and get studied some more? Or
remember.
Yeah, maybe I'm the only one on this, but let me just lay out what I have problems, but where I don't have problems with the bill and where I do. I don't have a problem with section one. I don't have a problem with section two, section three. We dealt with section four, and frankly, I'm ambivalent on that. That's seven out of nine, I think. I hear the argument on both sides. I do still have a problem with the definition of impaired in section 7.9 of this. I do have a problem in subsection 9, which we haven't talked about, on page 3, line 6, that deals with the crime of harassment. And the crime of harassment is something that we haven't dealt with, Mr. Chairman. Let me read you what it says. It's a specific provision of harassment. Letter 61-120. A6. 120A6. Yeah. A person commits a crime of harassment with the intent to harass or annoy another person. If with the intent to harass or annoy another person, that person. That's the domestic violence provision. I was reading another one before. I don't have a problem with that. We went over this kind of quickly before. I do have a problem with particularly. And I guess this goes to the situation somebody says you can't cure everything in this statute, but simply saying you criminalize somebody because they happen to be a felon and another person in a dwelling house happens to have a handgun. And I understand how that can be subject to abuse, but I also, pardon me?
It requires a knowing that it's in the house.
Even if you know that it's in the house, I mean, you can. Once again, you can have an adult child, an extended family, and or a parent or some short-tail relative who happens it could even be that you're living in the house. It's not even your house. And the owner happened to have a pistol somewhere in another part of the house. It has nothing to do with you. And you make the person a felon for that. That does bother me, the handgun under those conditions. And I'm not sure how you draft it, but I just have problems criminalizing somebody. I don't have a problem when they say, no, it's not mine, it's my husband's or my wife's or something, and they Pinocchio it off. But I'm not sure how you deal with all of those problems. Those are my main problems with the bill, Mr. Chairman, particularly the that definition of the lack of definition of impaired, and in all cases criminalizing somebody for the handgun so that somebody else has it, they just have to live in the same place. Those are my two main problems with the bill.
No, I'm
just reminded on the impaired issue that if you look at page 2, line 21, there is language they're talking about substantially impaired when it's illegal to sell a gun to somebody. And that's been in the statute since 1978. Impaired is not defined there, and it's never been a problem. It's not been an enforcement problem, and it's not been a legal problem. And as we discussed in an earlier committee hearing, the reason that we distinguish between substantially impaired there and impaired in Section 7 is that when you are talking about a store owner selling a gun to somebody else, you want to make sure that they are darn sure or aware of what's going on, so you say substantially impaired, as opposed to somebody being intoxicated and having a weapon, that should be a lower standard of impaired. So that is where the language came from. It's been in the statute since 78. It has never been a problem.
I understand what you're saying. And I would feel more comfortable if you said substantially impaired, because that makes it easier for the trier of fact to determine whether the person is guilty.
Okay. except that then you are in fact raising the standard. If you put in substantially impaired, you are raising the standard of when somebody can have a weapon. And the point is, if they are impaired by alcohol or impaired by drugs, they shouldn't have weapons. They shouldn't have firearms.
Well, then why do you, then, if that's the case, then you would want to remove the word substantially on the line 21 too?
No, because you need to make sure that the person who is selling the gun is actually aware that the person is impaired. And so you are making it be a standard that is high enough so the person isn't going to be inadvertently committing a crime. You make it be substantially impaired so the person can see and be aware of when they're violating the law. The person who's doing the sale.
I understand why you're saying that. But I think that it has another effect as well, and that is that the trier of fact must be convinced that the person in the one case was quite impaired. The question of whether somebody is, quote, impaired or not is a real subjective thing. If any of you ever sat on a DWI jury, you look at a videotape. I once defended somebody who had a 3.0 or 3.2. They said if it was another half a point, the person would be dead. And the person had killed somebody in a sports car. And she was very lucky that she wasn't charged with manslaughter. But she came across on the videotape totally sober. Totally sober. And the jury in that particular case, and there was the, don't forget, in that case, there was a blood alcohol sample. It took them 8 hours to come back with a verdict. They finally convicted him. But I think it was only because of the scientific evidence. And that's, you know, everybody, so I'm saying everybody has a war story on one side or the other.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the point was, is impaired a definite enough term? And the only point that I was trying to make is that language has been in the statute for 12 years now and has never been a problem. It's never been an enforcement problem on the one hand, and it's never been a legal problem on the other hand.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very brief on this. There are various reasons why people may, from a prosecutor's point of view, escape conviction. It may be lousy facts, it may be one of a number of things, you may have drawn a bad jury, or who knows. But the question is, if we're talking here about changing, we're talking about repealing a statute and having no definition in the statute, is there anybody, and I'd ask any of the prosecutors, because we've got at least three prosecutors in this office, in this room, and we have no defense attorneys, but I'd like to ask any of the three prosecutors, is there anybody who has had any experience with an actual jury or a judge tried case where they couldn't understand the definition here in 215? That was the reason that they acquitted. Maybe Ms.
Yes, my case that I told you.
Did you talk to
the jury afterwards, and the reason was they couldn't understand this. It didn't make sense to them. And I set out, like I was telling you earlier, I asked prosecutors statewide, are there statutes that you have problems with? And I can't tell you if it was three or if it was four, but I got back from three or four different heads of offices, that this is an unenforceable statute.
You know, this sounds like the exact same question we've been over, and mm-hmm. we asked the same question. I think we've asked it three times now. And we did it at the last meeting, we did it at this meeting twice already. This is the third time this meeting we've had.
This is the first time we have dealt with this issue. I have
No, we talked about it twice before, two other meetings, because we talked about whether or not to go to the blood alcohol level and why we couldn't do that. And
very briefly, Margo, can you, our Juneau judge, Peter Freilich, has ruled that as a matter of law, he's not going to let it go to the jury unless he sees the evidence of the intoxication affecting their possession of the gun. He's not going to let a jury even decide whether 215 has been met or not unless he thinks there is this evidence showing that the person is demonstrably doing something different as they're holding the gun than a sober person would be doing at that precise moment.
Would the way he would try these cases be different if the statute were as indicated here?
Yes.
He has said that?
He has said that this language has to mean something special, the language of 215, and it's different than the substantially impaired or the impaired language. And it may be that impaired is not perfect, but it's so much better than what we have now. Thank you.
Representative Miller. Mr. Chairman, for the opening up as we're approaching 4:30, Gary, maybe to get us off dead center somewhat, I'm going to propose an amendment because I think this is going to be a discussion that's going to be all the way, it's going to follow the bill all the way down, and it's going to be the semi-automatic discussion. And as an owner of a Mini 14, which about several years ago, I can appreciate some of the discussions that was brought up on it, but I'm going to make the motion that we strike the words "or semi-automatic firearm" in line 14 and 17 on page 2. I believe that's really the only place that's dealing with the felon.
Page 3, line 9.
Okay.
Then do we need to have the definition?
And then, okay. All that would go in that motion. I'll make that motion.
Why don't I go ahead? I think what I'd like to do is just hold the bill over, and then go ahead and put the, go ahead and we'll have staff put that in writing for you.
That's fine.
And then we'll just come back if we need.
It would probably be better to have a full committee hearing.
Yeah. So we'll go ahead and do it that way.
Some of my concerns now that I've really gelled my thinking, I'm going to check that one aspect a little further, and I may come back and be more satisfied.
Okay. I guess what I want to do at this point is to really encourage members to put any. The next time this is before us, I'd like the amendments to be in writing.
Sure.
And we can anticipate it either, I don't know if we'll have time tomorrow, but probably the next day, probably Thursday. Can we at least adopt the CS or something to work off of? Because we've gone through a bunch of different versions.
I'll move the CS.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection to CS before the committee for now, so we can give this out to folks. Okay. Let's see. We've got ERA. Okay.
You don't have time for that one.
Was anybody? Let's see. Let me see if there's anybody from here to testify on it. Actually, what is the 26? I don't have anybody signed up on here to testify. Is there a sheet back there? Okay. Well, is there somebody signed up to testify on this that I don't know about?
Mona Mayhar from my office.
I was going to testify on support of it, but I submitted a paper.
Okay.
That.
Well, it's hard for me to know that unless people sign up. I really need people to sign up in the future, okay? If anybody wants to come forward and testify on this bill, I'll just go ahead and have it. HCR 26?
Okay.
Okay. Can you have Sherry so she can sign in? Thanks.
Oh.
I know. If you gotta go, it's okay.
I gotta meet at 4:30.
Yeah. Sorry.
No problem. It's a good discussion.
Yeah. And I know Representative Martin is really interested in this proposal too. So.
Well, he mentioned it to me today. Normally, I would have my staff present it for the witnesses.
No, I would.
We could take the other witnesses at some point. That's more of a.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Gall. I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. As you might imagine, the Women's Lobby is very much in support of a federal ERA, and therefore, of course, we support a resolution that would recommend that the state supports the federal government passing a federal ERA and bringing it back to the states for ratification. In your packets, I believe you have a position paper that I have submitted previously that pretty much lays out why we think it's important to have an ERA. We, of course, have an ERA section of our own constitution in the state, which has done us no harm, but it would certainly be nice to finally, in all these years, I guess it's been 60 some odd years since women have been proposing to have equal rights in the United States Constitution, to finally the Civil Rights Restoration Act, the Equal Pay Act, and the Equal Credit Act. But it seems that those have not really provided adequate protections for women. The Constitution's 14th Amendment does not even provide adequate protection for women, as was somewhat made clear, I think, in the last, in the hearings on the Supreme Court nominee at that time, Justice Souter, when it was discussed that women or gender is not really considered a suspect classification under the 14th Amendment. It doesn't have that kind of protection. And one of the reasons it doesn't is because women are not necessarily a minority. And of course, we would, of course, support equal rights for women under the law in our country, and we do support this resolution very much. Thank you.
Any questions for the witness?
Thank you.
Would anybody else like to testify? Representative Grunberg, would you?
I'm sorry.
Would you just like to?
Well, yeah, was there anybody else in the audience?
I don't want to testify. I was going to testify if there was some opposition to the bill, but I was primarily the paper I submitted just will suffice.
It will certainly be added to the record.
I would ask that Mona Mayahara and my staff be permitted to.
Certainly.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Mona Mayahara. I'm on staff with Leslie Grunberg. I appreciate the resolution being passed. I am minority in several respects. I am of Japanese ancestry, a fourth generation Japanese American. I am a female and I'm also short. We have laws that protect my right as an Asian American, and I appreciate that. However, I have personal experience discrimination based on my gender. I am a single parent and I've raised my son for 15 years. And it's been extremely difficult because the economic opportunities are not equitable out there. There is not comparable pay. There is not child care. There are not these opportunities that make it possible for females trying to support a family. It's extremely difficult, and I'm speaking from personal experience. I'm hoping that this resolution does pass. I think, as you can see in your packets, resolutions have been introduced in Congress this year in both the Senate and the House, and I believe they will be passed, and therefore I think this resolution on the part of the state of Alaska would be very supportive. I think it will show that I think Alaska has the interest of individuals, not just females or males, but individuals very much in mind here. After we pass this resolution, I hope to work on Representative Grunberg to pass a short person's resolution.
Hey, I'll sign that one.
But again, I would urge you all to look at this resolution and consider it very seriously, especially in light of this recent Persian Gulf conflict. Just for your edification, I know many of you have seen females participating in this conflict. I know many of you have also have heard of that one female a personnel that was missing in action, Melissa Neely, while she has been returned yesterday. But did you also know that we have lost a few females in that action? There have actually been four females who have been killed in action, and this is in hostile action, in the Persian Gulf. This is four out of the 160 fatalities that the American forces had experienced. You know, that alone, I think, is just indicative of the kind of sacrifice that women have been making for our country, for our society. And I think it's due, women have that right, it's due to them to be treated equally. And that's all we ask, to have equal benefits and opportunities in our society. Again, I urge you all to support this resolution. I do believe that it's quite optimistic that it passed Congress this year, and I hope that we will successfully ratify this nationwide. Thank you.
Any questions for members? The only thing that I would, not a question, it's just something that members need to know. In 1983, the 13th legislature passed a resolution urging that the ERA be again submitted to the states. And that was when it became apparent that it was bogging down. And Representative Barnes pointed that out to me and said, why do we need to pass another one? I think in view of the recent events in the Persian Gulf, where women really did bear their fair share, and everybody has seen it firsthand on television, and we have a bill that 47 out of the 100 senators have sponsored in the U.S. Senate on the first day when it was put in. I don't know if any of people have sponsored it since, and about 100 congressmen, and it's very much before us, it's appropriate to do it 8 years later. That is the way we have never done this before.
Who's
it
for now?
Just a quick point of information here. I have a 4:30 view. Do you want to move this one out again?
We had the meeting only scheduled till 4 o'clock, so I don't want to take action without the members having the opportunity.
I appreciate you. And I apologize, Representative Cardinal, I forgot to get on this one.
Anybody else wish to testify on the resolution? Okay. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you.
Sure. When we get a quorum, this is a pretty straight up and down question. Terry's told me he wants 30 minutes to talk.
Okay.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.